I think one of the challenges that I've seen a lot of families face with the diagnosis of muscular dystrophy is trying to fight to change the future that you've been handed for your sons at the same time that you're trying to embrace and live the fullest in the present. And I hope you'll forgive me for a very coarse metaphor, but it's almost like you had a really long-awaited release of a book. You finally got your copy, you started reading it, and you loved it, and then somebody told you an unhappy ending in exquisite detail and then left you to enjoy reading the rest of the book. It's hard to do that. I remember a colleague of mine told me once that she thought one of the most important but most difficult skills that a parent needs to learn in order to have their children feel secure and connected was for the parent to learn how to be fully present with the child in the moment. And I would say that's very difficult to do when you're focused on changing your past or rewriting your child's future. So in the 20 minutes that I have, I'm going to only attempt to raise a number of issues that I hope is just going to stimulate conversations throughout this meeting over the next several days, both within the breakout sessions, but perhaps even more importantly, outside of the sessions as you talk with each other. And I encourage you to continue these discussions when you return home. I trust that the answers ultimately are going to come from within your own family and your network of friends, but I would encourage you to take advantage of the insights and the suggestions of the other families at this conference because they've gathered a lot of experiences and developed a lot of the insights that I hope I'm going to be able to share. So one of the earliest struggles confronting the families of a child with Duchenne has been balancing the natural desire to protect your sons from worries and concerns about their health and their future with the goal of trying to maintain open communication to foster ultimate adjustment and the development of self-management skills in your sons. At last year's conference, I concentrated my presentation on addressing the importance of open communication and the benefit of early disclosure of the Duchenne's diagnosis to the affected children and all of the children in the family, coupled with simple and age-appropriate explanations of the medical condition, but without giving unnecessary detail or attempts to predict the future for any individual child. By initiating the conversations very early, these discussions can be initially quite brief. Another coarse metaphor, it's similar to approaching education for your children about sexual health. If you start very early on by just naming body parts and answering very simple questions in developmentally appropriate ways, the conversations start out real simple and very short. Children then are more likely to come to see their parents as they grow older as appropriate, competent, and trusted sources of important information in this area. I would contrast that to families that choose to avoid the topic, shroud it in secrecy and shame, and wait until the night before their child's wedding to begin the discussion. And I will tell you by then it's very likely that the discussion is going to be awkward and of no practical value, since the children will have already gone somewhere else for the information, and I assure you, already acted on it, on that information from other sources, whether or not it was accurate. Secrecy also creates a burden within families, and they invest a lot of time and energy, which they have little of either of those commodities, in efforts to maintain the secret, even though in many situations everyone, particularly the child, already knows. Rarely is it successful, and the children often find out inadvertently by overhearing comments that are made, and they become angry with their parents and the healthcare team, and then distrustful. Because even very young children know when something is wrong, even if you've tried to hide it from them. Now, in my interactions with families of children with Duchenne's, I've noted very wide variability in how parents have chosen to handle this. Some have started very early on with open disclosures, and others have fiercely resisted any discussion with their children. Overall, though, the one thing that I have seen that seems to be the same is that they almost all feel unsure about the merit of their approach. Even when I have seen parents who have done an exceptional job, they still aren't sure that they have. And I guess it's hard to feel like you're doing a good job when you're talking about something that's potentially distressing. Because when you do a really good job, you either uncover your son's distress or you share your own, and that doesn't feel like it's going well, even when it is. So that's another reason why it's a great benefit for you to talk to others, to obtain their perspective and or validate your own. Talk with other parents, talk with healthcare providers, or other formal or informal supports. And if you're not comfortable talking with your friends and relatives about this, then I would consider talking with professionals so that they can give you some advice and perspective. I would say you should seek expert guidance on addressing the emotional health of your son and your family, and that includes yourself, with the same care and attention that you approach the physical health needs of your son and your family. And I would say both are closely interrelated, and you need to attend to both of them. And I hope we'll use this conference as an opportunity to either start or perhaps continue that process. Now, the emphasis of what I talked about last year was on young children's capacity, desire, and need to know and understand about their illness and its treatment. So today, what I would like to do is talk more about the importance of not only sharing that information, but also exploring some of the associated feelings. And since I don't have that much time, what I thought I would do is just briefly discuss 10 myths that I have heard expressed directly or indirectly by parents or professionals, whether it's within the Duchenne community or even in other related or unrelated conditions, that I'd like to challenge and have you think about it. The first one is, my child isn't upset because he doesn't understand his medical condition and its implications. And I would say if children are completely unaware that anything is wrong, yes, they're probably unlikely to be upset about it. But rather than being unaware, children are much more likely just to be ill-informed. And that tends to generate confusion and anxiety, and it leads children to seek information from alternate sources. And for many of these children, that will be the internet. We need to warn children about the conclusions that they draw from information on the internet. It may be inappropriate for anyone, inappropriate for their developmental level, inaccurate, or simply just not appropriate or applicable to their own condition. So, for example, the outcome data will be based on children with Duchenne's who did not have the benefit of a lot of the treatments we have now, such as some of the steroid use that we have now. But we can't provide children with any warnings if we pretend they're unaware or uninterested. And in the absence of accurate information, children tend to reach erroneous and very worrisome conclusions. I'm going to give you an example that I think I may have used last year. I was taking care of a 12-year-old boy who had sickle cell disease in the hospital. He had been admitted for what they thought were transient ischemic attacks, small strokes. He was having periods of being dizzy and of nearly fainting. And they thought that might be a sign of small strokes occurring because of his sickle cell disease. And they admitted him. And after I got to know him, after only about 4 or 5 days in the hospital, he finally looked at me and he said, "You know, I'm the oldest." And I said, "The oldest what?" And he said, "I'm the oldest boy in the sickle cell clinic." And I said, "What do you think happens after that?" And he said, "I presume you die. And that means I will die soon." And I said, "No, you get transferred to the adult clinic at 13. It's across the street." And at that point, I introduced him to another boy on the ward who was 18 years old and had sickle cell disease. He turned around and he said to everyone, "I'm feeling better now. I think I can go home." So the issue is you don't even know what they're thinking a lot of the time, but it can have very major implications for their health care and for their emotional health. So then the next myth is, if you don't know exactly what to say, it's better to say nothing at all. I would say if this were true, you wouldn't have any substantive conversations with our children, and you would be functionally mute in the presence of teenagers. In many situations, saying nothing is precisely the wrong thing to say. Let me get to the next one. Well, talking about his condition is just going to upset him. We have to remind ourselves that the discussion itself doesn't cause the distress. It merely invites children to ask questions and to share their concerns, and thereby allows us to see the distress that the children are already experiencing. And that is distressing to adults, to see their kids upset. But it's the condition itself, not the conversation about it, which is what's really causing the distress. And quite frankly, children should be distressed about things that are distressing. I had one parent contact me who had been advised by a healthcare provider to consider starting his son on antidepressants before they disclosed the diagnosis to him. And I said, "I really think it is upsetting information, and I think it's appropriate to feel upset. And he needs to deal with that feeling in order to be able to process it." The next myth is stated in different ways. It may be, "My son is doing well. I can tell when my child is upset." Or the flip side is, "I'm so close to my child, I would be the first one to know." if he were upset. Well, unfortunately, in reality, parents generally underestimate the extent of children's reactions in difficult situations, especially related to how they feel internally, their internal distress. This was one of the posters that Project Liberty put up in New York City about 6 months after the attacks on September 11th, 2001. They all said the same thing: if only the signs were this easy to read. This young man has "feeling worthless" on his jacket, had a girl with "depressed" written out in jewelry around her neck. And unfortunately, they don't wear it on their clothes. It isn't always that obvious. And children often attempt to withhold their complaints of how they're feeling internally when they're upset because of concerns that it means there's something abnormal about them, or at least inappropriate, or frankly, they wish to protect their parents or other adults around them who they sense are upset, and they also know are upset when they are upset. And children with potentially serious medical conditions often perceive that somehow it is their task to provide support to their parents and other adults, and they therefore join in the mutual pretense that they're unaware of the seriousness of their condition. This conspiracy of silence, though, just isolates the child from available supports and leaves him alone to deal with his feelings, his fears, and his concerns. So the next issue is, well, maybe they are distressed, but the myth is children are resilient, and therefore they don't need assistance. They'll bounce back and recover. Well, it is true that many children, as adults, have remarkable capacity to adjust to even very difficult challenges, such as dealing with a chronic medical condition, especially when it's the only reality they have ever experienced. But resilience is not an all-or-nothing phenomenon. Partial coping in no way guarantees the complete adjustment will follow automatically. And coping and adjustment are accelerated by ongoing support and assistance, so we should be making every effort to provide that support. So then parents say, well, I can't be of any assistance to my son if I'm still struggling myself. I need to wait until I'm okay with his diagnosis before I reach out and help him. Do a lot of work in crisis response. And this comment is a variation of a reference that I have heard many times to the statement made by flight attendants that in the event that the cabin loses pressure and oxygen masks fall from the ceiling, adults should place the masks on themselves first before assisting their children. I've heard this in so many crisis response presentations. What I have never heard said is that it is assumed that you assist your child within a couple seconds. You don't wait until the plane has landed safely. And too often I find parents are waiting until they're no longer upset or distressed themselves by the situation before they venture to help their children. And unfortunately, for the condition you're dealing with, that's going to be a very long time for many of you. Now, it is true that children's adjustment is highly dependent on their parents' adjustment. So it is very important to take care of yourself so that you can be better able to assist your own children. But children also benefit from knowing that their parents have similar or additional concerns and learning how to deal with troubling or distressing feelings. So parents can and should teach coping skills by modeling them to children. You can't model coping if you don't model distress. There was actually a study done many years ago looking at preparation of children for tonsillectomy. And they tested two different videos. In the first video, they showed a child of a similar age getting prepared for the procedure and acting very excited and happy about the fact they were going to have their tonsils out, they were going to have a good time in the hospital, they would be able to get all of this ice cream, and they would just be fine. Then they showed another video of a boy or girl who was distressed. They didn't want to go in the hospital. They were scared about the surgery. They were distressed about how it would hurt. And then they showed how the child coped with that, and then in the recovery period that individual was now adjusted. They found that children did much better when they saw the video where they show the child initially distressed, because that's how they were feeling. And therefore, they learned how to cope because the child's experience mirrored their own. So if you're trying to hide your distress to support your child, that may actually not be the best way of helping them. They need to see your distress, and then they need to see how you deal with it effectively. Then the next statement comes, okay, I'll show them my distress, but I don't know how to help my child deal with something that's upsetting. Well, parents actually have the longest history with their children of anyone else in most situations, and they know what they have tried and what has worked in the past to help their children when they were upset or in distress for other reasons. And a good place to start is with those coping techniques that the child has already learned and mastered, and then seek other options and suggestions from others as additional strategies to attempt with your child. Then the next issue I hear is, well, because of this condition, it's really most important to have quality time with my child. And talking about or thinking about something that is unpleasant is not, in my opinion, quality time. And I would say, yes, it is very important to have enjoyable experiences with your son and the rest of your family. But quality time doesn't mean avoiding important things, like education, helping your son understand and take increasing responsibility for management of his own condition, and making sure he learns to respect and understand limits and responsibilities. So quality time does mean also important things have to be accomplished as well. Then I hear people say, well, I need to treat every day as if it were his only day. And I find that many parents feel either cheated by the potential loss of time with their son or guilty that they are not able to guarantee that their son will have a long, healthy, and happy life. And I would say if you try to make every day count enough to somehow compensate for the possibility of having fewer days in the future, then it's a good chance you're going to be disappointed. If instead you try to make the most of every day because you want to enjoy the present, irrespective of the past and independent of the future, the chances are far better you will actually enjoy the present. This, in my opinion, is the difference between treating every day as a gift versus treating today as compensation for something owed to you. Parents who try and fit a lifetime of enjoyment into every day end up with overscheduled and exhausted families and children that are overindulged, unable to deal with disappointment, and that fail to become responsible and competent youth and adults. The reality is, you can't live a lifetime in a day. I have a hard enough time living a day in a day. And so we just need to try and do that to start with. The last myth I wanted to mention is, they say, well, what we're experiencing is just a normal reaction to an abnormal situation, so we don't need any counseling. In my work with crisis response, this is actually a very common expression shared with people, somehow meant to reassure individuals that their reactions don't indicate that they're crazy or emotionally disturbed. But unfortunately, this tends to perpetuate the stigma associated with mental health and mental illness, and it blocks people from obtaining helpful services. I was in the pediatric clinic one day, and one of the residents came out, and he had just seen a 6-year-old girl that had been attacked by a pit bull a week prior. She'd come to the emergency room and had her leg sutured in multiple layers because it was such a deep wound. And he wanted me to come take a look at the wound to see if it was healing properly. And so before I went in, I asked, well, how is she doing emotionally? And he said, well, he knew I was a developmental behavioral pediatrician, so he asked before he came to me. So he said, well, the mom says that she's doing quite well. And then he paused and said, and I asked the girl. And she said she was doing well. So I went into the room. The girl was smiling. Mother seemed in a good mood. I asked how things were going. The mother said things are going well. The girl smiled and said things are going well. I looked at the wound and it looked fine. But before I left the room, I just said, well, how is she doing in school? And the mom said, I don't know. And I said, why not? She said, she's afraid to leave the house. She's afraid she'll be attacked by dogs, so she hasn't left the house all week. So I said, well, how is she sleeping? And she said, she has nightmares every night. She dreams she's being attacked by dogs. And I said, well, does she startle easily? And she said, oh, yeah, you close the door. She jumps. She's afraid the dogs are coming to attack her. So we went over how to deal with some of the fears that the girl had and explained that we wanted to hear about that. And we were going to see her in a week just to talk about how she was doing emotionally. And then, quite frankly, I didn't want to see the wound again because I don't like the way wounds look. And so I said, you can stay dressed next time, and we'll just talk about that. And the mother was very grateful, and the girl was very grateful. But before I left, I said, I don't want to be rude, but let me just ask you a question. You had two doctors ask both of you how your child was doing, and you both said yes. And it doesn't sound like she's doing as well as we'd all like. Why did you say that? I'd just like to learn from that. And the mother looked at me, and she said, if you were attacked by that dog, you'd do exactly the same thing my daughter is. And I thought, yes, I probably would. And if I was shot, I too would bleed, just like everybody else. But nobody would ever say to me that shock is a normal reaction to the abnormal situation of massive blood loss. Do you want an ambulance? Do you need an ambulance? So the issue is, The question isn't whether or not someone needs counseling, but whether or not they might benefit from it. And if the answer is yes to that, then we should help them access those services. So what I wanted to end with for just a minute is a brief discussion of where you might look for those supports for children and for yourself and other family members. Obviously, you can turn for informal supports to other families of children with Duchenne's, where you share a diagnosis and some common experiences. But I would also encourage you to turn to other families who do not have family members with Duchenne's. You also share a lot in common with them. Your child is not defined solely by his diagnosis, and neither is your family defined exclusively by your son's diagnosis. They may have other suggestions that they can help you with. Obviously, you can turn to your extended family and your community and all types of community, whether that be religious community or your network of friends and neighbors. And in many situations, it may be helpful to turn to professionals. The last point I would like to make is a lot of people ask me, well, who is a psychologist, a social worker, a psychiatrist in my particular rural town in another part of the country who has experience with Duchenne's families? And usually what I tell them is a lot of the adjustment that you're dealing with, anybody who is a good therapist will be able to help you with. So what's more important is to find individuals with strong counseling skills who you are comfortable relating with and can develop a good relationship with, and then they can help you with some of the issues that you and your child will be facing. So I hope to talk to some more of you and hear some of your answers to some of the questions I've raised over the course of the conference. Thank you.